This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Monday, college football's champion will be determined. Everybody agrees on that, except the fans of Boise State, who think their undefeated team should have a share of the title, and then the fans of Michigan, because they maintain that they only lost to USC in the Rose Bowl because it wasn't the BCS championship game, and the fans of USC because they beat Michigan and would have beaten Ohio State if they'd only been given the chance. Joining me now to testify regarding the utter success of the BCS Championship Series at settling all controversies is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me back.
We'll get to college football's most recent game of games in just a minute, but perhaps we should review first what's been a pretty entertaining bowl season. No game more entertaining, perhaps, than the New Year's night Fiesta Bowl between Boise State and Oklahoma. Sports hyperbole is cheap these days, but what do you think? Best bowl game ever?
Well, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a more entertaining football game ever played than that. It's certainly got to be on everyone's list because in the final 90 seconds of the game, you had so many shifts of momentum. Oklahoma came back and tied it. Then they took the lead and looked like they were going to win on an interception return. And Boise State made three straight incredible plays to end up winning the game in overtime. So the trick plays, the fact that it was an underdog, the fact we're talking about Boise State involved in this thing, and it was truly sports at its best because you had no idea what was going to happen next or who was going to deserve or who deserved it.
I hate to ask this question, but I have no choice. Does this game strengthen the case for a football playoff system, a tournament, as some have suggested?
Well, I think it continues to knock down the doubt that underdogs can't play with the elites. And I think that college football is leaving a lot on the table by not having a playoff. I can't imagine what the television ratings would be and the hoopla and the excitement if Boise State was playing again next week in a semifinal against Ohio State or the finals against Ohio State. This would be truly America's team. And the excitement and the drama and the buildup would be so immense. To not have that and not allow that just because of the old way of making so much money on this doesn't make sense.
Of course, you have to wonder also what a Boise State player playing the following week could do to top the guy who asked a cheerleader to marry him while they both were still in uniform.
Yes, right after the game, after scoring the game-winning two-point conversion, the running back, Ian Johnson, asked his girlfriend, who's the, of course, head cheerleader of the Boise State team, to marry him live on Fox television. So I would think that more people in America would rather see Boise State play another game than Ohio State and Florida play in the national championship game. Everybody can get into this story. Everyone gets the little guy, the romance, the crazy plays, the fact that we're talking about the state of Idaho. The greatest thing to happen to Idaho.
Football capital of the world.
Since the invention of the potato.
On Wednesday night, Louisiana State routed Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl to the surprise of few. It's been 9 straight bowl losses for the University of College Football in America, many of those losses by lots and lots of points. Maybe it's time to do the unthinkable and consider Notre Dame no longer worthy of an automatic BCS bowl bid.
They're no Boise State, you can say that. Notre Dame does not have very good football players on their team. That is the biggest problem. The amount of media hype and attention from NBC and ESPN and all the preseason magazines, because they sell, people tune into the games and they sell magazines and they sell newspapers, the hype makes these guys familiar, but it doesn't make them ferocious football players. Until Charlie Weiss rebuilds the program with better recruits, and there is a sign that he is already en route to doing that, including signing some of the best recruits for next year, this is how it is. So 9 straight bowl losses, it's a record. Next year will probably be a rebuilding year. Notre Dame's got a lot of work to do before they're anything more than a lot of hype.
Nick Saban, who turned a national championship with Louisiana State 3 years ago into a job in the NFL, has returned to college football. He will be the head coach at Alabama after a month-long courtship. During that time, Saban told reporters repeatedly that he would not leave the Miami Dolphins, which of course meant that he would leave the Miami Dolphins. Are we at the point where we have to assume that all coaches are lying when their lips are moving?
If a coach tells you it's sunny out, bring an umbrella. Nick Saban is a tremendous college football coach. He will get the Crimson Tide back to greatness very, very quickly. In terms of telling the truth, he is about as straight as the Coosa River.
Dan, we should look ahead to Monday's BCS Bowl Championship extravaganza and Festival of Lights. Most observers thought that Michigan and Ohio State were clearly the two best teams in college football, and their matchup back in November was the de facto title game. However, Michigan lost by 14 points to USC in a game that probably wasn't in fact that close, the Rose Bowl. By that measure, is Ohio State in danger of a Florida upset?
Oh, I think Florida can play with Ohio State. I think any of the top teams can play with each other. It's not a situation. Again, college football, because it's such a unique and unusual, the way they do things, they are prone to complete hyperbole and overhype, which is, fun when you're in the media, but it doesn't really tell you much about what's really going on. And so the idea that that was the greatest game of all time only lasts for a couple weeks. Florida is every bit good enough to beat Ohio State. There's no way to really tell who's going to show up after the long layoff. There's very few common opponents to judge things. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with very young players, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old. The roller coaster for young players is so dramatic that you just really have no way of predicting these things.
In Columbus, Ohio, Buckeye fans can prepare for that battle in Glendale by feasting on alligator fillets, now on sale at local stores in Ohio. I don't know. It kind of makes me glad the Michigan Wolverines didn't make it to the title game, because who knows what Buckeyes would be eating if that had happened.
Well, I know this about eating an alligator, is the alligator would eat you.
Well, the Wolverine probably would if there were enough of them, I guess.
Maybe if you laid down very still, they'd give it a shot.
Dan Wetzel covers college football, among other things, for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks again, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Bill.
Buckeye, Arizona was named by settlers from Ohio back in the late 19th century, before Arizona was even a state. Now the burgeoning town of about 40,000 is trying to capitalize on Ohio State University's appearance in Monday's BCS championship game. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Mark Moran reports.
A half hour's drive west from Phoenix, Buckeye's like a completely different world. It looks like the backdrop for an old western, and with good reason. Travelers from Ohio settled the town in 1888, long before Arizona was even a state. There's a small red and white sign strung above Main Street, welcoming people to the Buckeyes for Buckeye Day Festival. Jim Harkin is Buckeye's Main Street Coalition Director.
It's increased visibility in Buckeye. It's also a chance to kind of go back to our roots, if you will. The founder of the town of Buckeye is actually from Ohio and was a Buckeye years and years ago, back in the 1800s. And it's just kind of a way to kind of show that connection and just share our town with people across the country. It's no secret that people retire to Arizona, and hopefully we can get some of the Ohio folks to come out this way, too.
When we create the design on the computer screen, it goes through an Ethernet system, which is a networking system to the cables, and I could send the designs either to the four-head machine or the single-head machine.
While the town is decidedly Old West, at the back of Beard's Western Wear, Jim Burke is programming a computerized sewing machine that's embroidering thousands of T-shirts and hats for Buckeye fans officials hope will come to town. Like these Ohio State grads who came to Beard's for a free T-shirt.
O-H.
I-O.
Go O-H.
Go Buckeyes. I-O. Go Buckeyes.
Mary Gwynn is here with her husband and some friends and has a pair of coveted tickets to the BCS championship game.
Beard's Western Country Store, may I help you?
According to Judy Beard, who owns the store with her husband Levi, Buckeye fans are not your typical tourists.
A lot of the people bring us their Buckeye nuts, which they're the the nuts from the Buckeye tree. And they bring them in the bags, and they hand us the bags, and they say, you need these nuts. And we're like, okay. And, you know, I have enough nuts now. We can make lots and lots of necklaces. I mean, it's funny. One of the ladies here, she brought some cord, and we drill a hole through them. And, you know, we put them on a necklace, and we wear them.
Ohio State has played in a bowl game in the Phoenix area in 4 of the last 5 years, and Buckeye has played this up. Now, says Judy Beard, the town has sort of adopted some of the fans.
We've been doing this for the past 5 years. They've kind of, like, made us family, I guess.
Today, local merchants will offer OSU merchandise. The Ohio State alumni band, there are enough in Buckeye to form one, will play the fight song. Visitors will have the chance to throw darts at a likeness of an alligator, which is the Florida mascot. And those who show their Ohio driver's license at Beard's Western Wear will get a free T-shirt. So what happens when Ohio State has a bad year and the Buckeyes don't play in an Arizona bowl game?
Oh, my gosh.
Levi Beard is Buckeye's vice mayor and owner of the Western Wear store.
I guess I'll have to open up the business that wherever Ohio State's going that year. We'll just have to keep rooting them on and hope for the best, I guess.
The Beards wouldn't be alone. Crowds at the Buckeye bowl games the last several years have been decidedly in favor of Ohio State. The school is known for its traveling fans. For now, the tens of thousands of fans who've made the trip to Arizona from Ohio are hoping for another national title. For Only a Game, I'm Mark Moran in Buckeye, Arizona.
If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to my weekly commentary, or to longer versions of my conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, shaking down the Epes at Notre Dame. But first, the NFL goes into its wild card weekend with a boatload of intrigue, unless you take into account that the AFC winner is guaranteed to win the Super Bowl this year. Here to usher us into the NFL postseason is the Sporting News, Paul Attner. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Bill, and I promise you this year I'm going to get it right.
Oh, good. Okay.
These predictions, I've been doing this with you for years, and this time we're going to be right.
Well, that's great, because I've always been a fan of novelty.
Right. I mean, let's introduce something different, a little fresh approach to this whole thing, right?
Before we address this weekend's games, we should perhaps discuss the resignation of Pittsburgh Steelers head coach Bill Cowher. How will the reigning Super Bowl champions fare in the near future without him?
Well, I think they've got a really good nucleus of talent, and I think if they choose the right guy, my guess is they're going to promote from within. They've got a chance to be very good, Bill. It's not that he's leaving because he doesn't see a future with the team. I think basically, and I applaud him, he's burned out. Yeah. And it's a cliche, and I hate to use it, but I think he really is. I think he's lost his zest for coaching. And of all the people in the coaching profession, no matter what level we're talking about, Bill Cowher is the one guy you think of for emotion. And I don't think he's there anymore. And so he should get out, or otherwise he's almost kind of like mailing it in, and I don't think he wants to do that.
Okay, on to the games. This afternoon, the Indianapolis Colts host the Kansas City Chiefs. Do you expect an upset, or will the Colts emerge victorious and just be defeated in the next round?
Well, that's right. Well, that's good. You beat me to my punchline, Phil. I think this is a game that if Kansas City, it was lucky they got in the playoffs, and then on top of that, they get a lucky draw here because of all the teams in the playoffs, the one they match up best with from an offensive standpoint is the Colts because the Colts have a hideous defense against the run, and the Chiefs are constituted of Larry Johnson to run the ball really well. So I'm looking for Larry Johnson to get 40, 50 carries in this game. And so, yeah, it does give the Chiefs a chance for an upset. But after that, they're out.
This evening, Dallas will play in Seattle. Which Cowboys team will we see? The resourceful squad that salvaged its season behind strong play from Tony Romo, the terrifying doppelganger featuring crabby Bill Parcells and crazy Terrell Owens, or something in between?
I think you're going to see Bill Parcells packing his bag and leaving.
During the game?
He may be tempted, I'm telling you. The thing about the Cowboys is they lost at home the final game of the season, the game they really needed to win because of playoff implications and seeding implications, to the Detroit Lions. The Detroit Lions had a hard time beating themselves, and yet the Cowboys couldn't beat them in Dallas. And so, you know, I really don't see them winning this game unless Matt Hasselbeck, the quarterback for the Seahawks, self-destructs. But I think Parcells has had it. It's been a very discouraging season for him. He certainly does not like Terrell Owens. He looks like a man disgusted with everything and maybe dreaming of a golf course someplace in Florida.
Tomorrow's game between the New England Patriots and the New York Jets holds much intrigue. One of the central questions is whether the game can transcend the great handshake controversy.
I love how we in the media take something and just run with it. And Bill Belichick and his former assistant coach, Eric Mangini, and, you know, Belichick didn't want him to go to the Jets, supposedly, and he did it anyway, and now Belichick has a vendetta against him because he didn't take his advice, and the two barely acknowledged each other after both games they played this season. And they were trying to make okay this week a little bit. But the teams are, you know, pretty evenly matched. The Jets really showed some improvement this year and gave the Patriots a difficult time, obviously, in beating them. So I think it's going to be a heck of a ball game. And I think you have to credit, you know, the fact that Mangini learned so much from Bill Belichick. And maybe that's what irritates Bill so much. He taught him too well.
Philadelphia hosts New York tomorrow. Are the Giants just happy to be there? And for that matter, are the Eagles just happy to be there, too?
I wonder if the Eagles understand what they've done. You know, it's like, hello, you know, they lose Donovan McNabb, their quarterback, midseason. Us wise folks who cover the NFL wrote them off, you know, automatically, said they're out. And now I think they're the best team in the NFC. That's not saying a whole lot, but I think they really are. A wonderful coach job by Andy Reid and great play by Jeff Garcia, the quarterback, who really is a retread and probably, I thought, over and done. But since taking over as a starter, he's really played better than McNabb. In the Giants, I mean, the Giants are lucky to be in the playoffs. They really aren't playing well, even when they beat the Redskins last week. And I think this is a team that understands that its future is going to be short-lived. I mean, they're not going to get beyond this game. And I think they're going to be happy about it. I don't think they like their coach, Tom Coughlin. I don't think Tom Coughlin likes them. So they want to get this done, and they all go home, and they don't have to see each other for a few months.
Baltimore and San Diego lay in wait for this weekend's AFC winners. Whichever two teams those winners are, it must be daunting for them to look forward to playing either the team with the NFL's best defense or the team with the 2006 most valuable player.
No, and the legitimate good teams in the league are in the AFC, and the two best teams in the AFC are the two you mentioned. In my discussions with people within the NFL, Baltimore's name emerges more than the Chargers as being the best within that conference, because not only for that defense, but Steve McNair has brought them so much stability at quarterback, Bill, that people feel that they can go into San Diego if that's what's going to be where the AFC Championship game is going to be played, and McNair is good enough to be able to withstand the pressure of being on the road against a decent Charger team and actually play well enough for the Ravens to win. So the Ravens are a team to watch, and they're very dangerous, and you know, the Chargers have a lot of glamour, but they're going to have to play very difficult physical football to be able to beat the Ravens.
All right, Paul, much of what you've said, I'm sure, is thoroughly considered and very wise, but people aren't going to be able to extract picks from it. So you better tell us now who's going to be in the Super Bowl and who's going to win it.
You know, as I predicted earlier, I didn't want to dodge this bullet. I'm going to face this, you know, head on this year. But, you know, I just played at Baltimore so bad, I better pick them, right?
I don't know. Have you just changed your own mind by that conversation?
I don't think so. You know, I'm going to stay with that. And in the NFC, Chicago is the favor going in. But their quarterback, Rex Grossman, last week in the final game, Bill, admitted he didn't study very hard. I'm saying to myself, you know, if you don't want to take your profession more seriously than that, how can your team win? So I'm going to go with the Eagles. It would have been a major upset, but the Eagles making from the NFC. But whoever makes it from the NFC is going to lose to the AFC team, so that means I pick the Ravens to win the Super Bowl.
Paul Attner covers the American game for the Sporting News. He's only a game's gridiron wild card as well. Paul, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it.
Although Notre Dame lost decisively to LSU 41-14 in Wednesday night's Sugar Bowl, it's been a pretty good year in South Bend. The football team finished its season with a 10-3 record. The men's and women's basketball squads both rank in the top 25 nationally. And last month, the Notre Dame women's soccer team reached the NCAA finals before losing a squeaker to North Carolina. And as Ron Schachter reports, students in a more obscure sport have also lived up to the nickname Fighting Irish.
Quick, what's the only Notre Dame team in the last 5 years to win two NCAA titles? If you're stumped, just ask the students at the school's snack bar.
Women's basketball?
I think women's basketball, too.
Track?
Track, probably, or cross country.
Women's soccer. Women, no, it's fencing.
It's fencing.
Is it fencing? You're kidding me.
That's right. It's the fencing team, which has claimed a total of 7 national championships and produced more than 200 All-Americans. Over the past decade, the fencers have averaged a 26-1 record, numbers that better those of the storied football program here.
Bitchiness. Two disengaged lunge. Oh, stay there.
This year's squad is anchored by a reigning Olympic gold medalist. And as senior co-captain Valerie Providenza notes, the team's accomplishments go largely unnoticed by fellow students.
Well, they didn't even know we had a fencing team, the majority of people that I've met, until I said, yeah, I'm on the fencing team. And guess what? We've won.
Once the main event in medieval castles and the sole province of elite Eastern schools, fencing went west years ago. At Notre Dame, the turning point came in 1971, says former coach Michael DiCicco, when the school hosted a junior world championship with young fencers from 35 countries.
And then no sooner did they go home, I'm getting phone calls, letters, telegrams. In those days, they didn't have computers, of kids who were interested in wanting to come to school here and fence here.
The men's team went on to win 4 NCAA titles under DiCicco, while the women's team, formed in 1974, captured another. Under present coach Janusz Bednarski, both sexes compete jointly. Their championships in 2003 and 2005 put Bednarski and DiCicco in select company as the only Notre Dame coaches, besides football legends Newt Rockne, Frank Leahy, and Ara Parseghian, to win multiple titles. Notre Dame's rectangular practice room is about the size of a basketball court and looks like a cross between a boxing gym and an intensive care unit. Here, students jump rope, perform the fencing equivalent of shadow boxing, or get individual coaching.
Right, can you see the distance for the parry, or if I stop, you attack after that one.
Others, hidden behind dark mesh face masks and clad from neck to ankle in white lamé suits, square off against each other. Each suit is connected by long wires to an electronic box on the far wall, which beeps and flashes green or red, depending on which combatant is touched by his opponent's weapon. Those weapons include the épée, saber, and foil. All have flexible, narrow blades, but differ in their weight and in the areas of an opponent's body that they are allowed to target. Notre Dame provides the NCAA maximum of 10 scholarships, divided equally among its men and women. And DiCicco, who coached here for 34 years, says that today's talent pool runs much deeper than in his early days.
I've seen it where a young man had come up and I have to tell them, this is a foil, this is a saber, this is an épée, and we go from there. The young man or young lady that comes to us now, they're coming from high schools, they're coming from other countries, they're coming from fencing programs. We're developing classes ourselves.
Junior Greg Howard, who took those fencing classes in nearby Mishawaka, specializes in the épée. He says he's seen a groundswell of interest.
I remember when I was first fencing, they would have national tournaments, and they would have a T-shirt for the tournament, and they would write the names of all the entrants on the back of the T-shirt. And a couple of years ago, they had to stop doing that because they just had too many entrants. They couldn't write them all on the back. It's not really like a national craze or anything, I don't think. But it's doing much better than it was.
It takes some doing, says junior foiler Mel Bautista, to get her classmates to appreciate her sport.
Usually it's like, wow, that's so cool. And that's like, is that like Zorro or Star Wars? And I'm like, well, kind of in a way, but it's not as theatrical. There's a lot more strategy and a lot more like formal technique connected to it. And a lot of people are like, so have you ever killed anyone?
Valerie Providenza, who won the national saber title 2 years ago, says that the crowds at fencing matches are growing and include more than family and close friends.
If you put the idea out there, people are really interested because they don't really know a lot about it. And so they want to see more. Even if they don't understand all of it, they think it's really exciting. They think, oh, Zorro, the movies. But then they come and they see that there's actually rules, things you need to do. It's definitely spreading the interest to people who would never even know we existed.
It's also helped that junior Mariel Zaygunas won Olympic gold in the Sabre event in 2004, a victory that was even announced between quarters at a Notre Dame football game. Still, if you search the hometown South Bend Tribune over the past 5 years, you'll find over 5,000 articles on football and barely a dozen on fencing. Senior Patrick Gaddis, an All-American saberist who's aiming for the 2008 Olympic team, sees an advantage in his relative anonymity.
It's always nice to get recognition, you know, to win an award or, you know, be the big man on campus or whatever, but flying under the radar has its benefits. The football team, they're nationally broadcasted every weekend. You know, if one screw up and they're going to be all over TV, you know. So, I mean, it's definitely nice since it's not on such a big stage. You're not as scrutinized as other bigger athletes in other sports.
For now, the Notre Dame fencers have their hands full with foes from Midwestern powerhouses Ohio State and Penn State to Yale and Harvard, which came from behind last spring to win the NCAA title. In November, they faced those teams at the Penn State Open, an annual kickoff event to the fencing season, and placed 3 women and 5 men among the top 10 finishers. In 2 weeks, the Fighting Irish host the Notre Dame Duels, a multi-team competition. This year's NCAA championships take place in late March in Madison, New Jersey. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in South Bend, Indiana.
You're listening to Only a Game. Having been frustrated in his attempts to put the National Football League on notice, Sam Haverstick of Louisville, Kentucky wrote this week to ask Only a Game to tell the NFL that unless they start firing players who step on their opponents' heads, wave guns around outside of nightclubs, or get caught with illegal drugs, he's going to stop watching the games. I would be immediately fired for the above offenses, he wrote. Wouldn't you guys? Chaz Hamilton, who hears the program on WRVO in Syracuse, New York, was unhappy with last week's Only a Game, a holiday tradition best-of show which revisited some of our favorite stories of 2006. 2 stories on surfing, 1 on auctioneering, 1 on indoor skydiving, and 1 on chili cooking, he wrote. Will you be covering sports in the future, or shall I stay in bed and sleep that extra hour? For the record, the auctioneers and chili cookers were competing with each other, but okay, Mr. Hamilton, you'll note that today's program is rife with football, and in just a few minutes, I'll be talking with a guy who wrote a book about basketball star Pete Maravich. My commentary on last week's program also caused some dismay. Stuart Murray of Berlin, New York, wrote, "You said, in effect, that the disappointing American performance at the World Cup this summer was something you could get over because you so enjoyed watching the games during the rest of the tournament." Mr. Murray considered this sentiment, or rationalization, or whatever it is, counterproductive if not treasonous. One day, the same spectator passion that lights up local American soccer will light up national team soccer, he wrote. One day, American fans will only be satisfied when the World Cup is held aloft in triumph during a victory lap by American soccer players. Several people wrote seeking the answer to a challenge posed by Mike Mahar, a New Hampshire listener, a couple of weeks ago regarding the fewest possible wins with which a team could capture Major League Baseball's championship. The answer, according to Mr. Mahar, is 41 games, and the winner would have to come out of the AL West. Should you wish to claim otherwise or contact us for any other reason, our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Write us at WBUR 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts 02215, or leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at bicon.com, bicon.com. And the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont. On the web at cabotcheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of a self-proclaimed basketball android. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Pittsburgh Steelers are looking for a new head coach after the resignation of Bill Cowher. The Steelers have had just two head coaches over the last 38 years. Do you think the Steelers management can remember where those application forms are?
I'm wondering if they can remember the room the desk is in that the application forms are in. This is going to be a difficult job to replace. Bill Cowher took on the task of rebuilding that team every couple of years because of the fact that they couldn't keep their people and kept losing them in free agency. They will obviously find a coach. Pittsburgh's a charter franchise in the National Football League, one of the flagship franchises of the National Football League. They'll find a coach, but the coach's job is going to be daunting in matching what Bill Cowher did in terms of being able to stay competitive in a small market.
It's wild card weekend.
Wild card!
You want to pick a wildest of wild matchups?
Well, the safest pick on the board seems to be Kansas City over Indianapolis because Indianapolis couldn't stop a junior high running team right now, and Kansas City has the great Larry Johnson. So I will pick Kansas City, although it's not exactly an upset. Everybody and his brother's doing that. The flavor of the month in the playoffs right now is Philadelphia. I think the Giants are going to go down to Philadelphia and beat them.
The Dolphins are floundering now that Nick Saban has left Miami to coach the Crimson Tide. Do you believe Saban when he says that his heart has always been and is now in college football?
I don't believe Nick Saban when he tells me the sun is rising in the east tomorrow. I don't believe Nick Saban if he tells me if I take a rock and drop it, it will hit the earth. I wouldn't believe Nick Saban if he came to me from a burning bush at this point. Now, what's your second question?
Would you like to suggest a dramatic College Bowl moment or two for our consideration, though most of them are, in fact, over?
Well, I mean, let us dispense with the now customary giggles for the annual ritual slaughter of the overrated that took place in the Sugar Bowl when LSU became the ninth consecutive team to embarrass Notre Dame in a bowl game. Mm-hmm. But without question, Boise State and Oklahoma was one of the two or three greatest sporting events I have ever watched on television. Bill, you would have been laughing hysterically at this game. You would have sworn allegiance to football for at least the 15 minutes after the game. Up to and including the now very tortured debate as to whether or not if you hand the ball off behind your back, it's truly a Statue of Liberty play or not. I maintain it's not.
What is your position, speaking of that game, on Boise State's claim that they deserve a share of the national title? I guess for entertainment value alone.
They have a share of my national title. I'll buy a trophy and send it to them because I had so much fun. I'd like to see a championship game between this team and I believe will be Ohio State, who I believe will thump Florida in a game that will be enormously forgettable, only to see what the Boise State coaching staff, what plays they'll draw up in the dirt over the week between the two games.
This week, two lacrosse players Duke University had suspended after allegations of sexual assault were invited back to school, Charlie, and they will be eligible to rejoin the team. Does it seem likely now that this case will just melt away?
I have no idea what's going to go on in this case right now. Everybody's involved. These guys are being invited back on what can be fairly described as a please don't sue us fellowship. What will happen with the case eventually, I have no idea. There are still charges pending. You've got an ethics committee of the North Carolina Bar looking at the prosecutor in the case now. It's possible it will disappear, but I don't think it will just melt away.
Randy Johnson is apparently headed back to the Arizona Diamondbacks. What, the Yankees don't need a Hall of Fame caliber left-handed pitcher?
Well, I mean, he was 34-19 during the time he was in New York, but he's got very bad back pain. The problem is he was 0-1 with a 6.92 ERA in the postseason, and that's what the Yankees will never forgive.
A recent study has shown that in 1998, official Major League Baseballs had a larger core and various other enhancements that made them bounce, I guess. Major League Baseball's chief operating officer, Bob Dupuy, said, quote, "We are satisfied that the ball comports with all Major League specifications." Did he mean that Major League Baseball had specified that a lot of home runs should be hit in 1998?
Let's see if we can sum it up for the benefit of listeners who may have joined us late. The players were juiced. The ball was juiced. The game was juiced.
Yay!
Res ipse loquitur, as they say on Law and Order. And yes, that's one of the great non-denial denials of all time for Mr. Dupuy.
The next Major League Baseball Hall of Famers will be announced on Tuesday. What do you make of the various arguments regarding Mark McGwire's worthiness or lack thereof and the way it has split your colleagues into bickering factions?
Well, there are a couple of idiot rules at play here. First, the idiot rule is nobody gets in unanimously on the first ballot. So that won't happen with McGwire. Second of all, there are going to be people who throw a lesson to America's children by not voting him in on the first ballot, which I think is what's going to happen. He's not going to make it. Third of all, we have the moral posturing, of which I've grown incredibly tiresome. But what really bothers me is that it's obliterating the fact that Cal Ripken and Tony Gwynn, both of whom richly deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, are going to go into the Hall of Fame.
Turning to basketball, 135 points is usually enough to win an NBA game in regulation, but that was not the case for the Golden State Warriors on Wednesday night,
well,
was it?
It's certainly usually enough to beat the worst team in the league, which is what the Memphis Grizzlies are, and Golden State managed to give up 144 points in regulation to the Grizzlies, who are now, of course, playing under an interim coach named Tony Barone, whose apparent philosophy is go ahead and run. I don't care. I don't know if I have the job anyway.
The same day that Miami Heat head coach Pat Riley announced that he would leave the team indefinitely to correct hip and knee problems, he benched Antoine Walker and James Posey because they're too fat. Is this Riley's bizarre way to get the Heat a high 2007 draft pick?
Well, I don't think Antoine Walker and James Posey were the particular problem with the Heat. The problem is that neither Dwayne Wade nor Shaquille O'Neal is healthy. Pat Riley is doing what most professional sports coaches do, which is basically knuckle people they don't need anyway. So, yes, Antoine Walker and James Posey will be on the exercise cycle for a couple of weeks.
In the past, we have discussed how old athletes should be before they turn pro, Charlie. How old do you think a mariner should be before sailing solo across the Atlantic Ocean?
Well, Mike Purham, a British teenager, has proven that the age could be 14.
He did it.
Yeah, he did it. He landed in Antigua. He had stopped in the Canary Islands and Cape Verde to replace satellite phones, which are a good thing. His father sailed behind him in another boat, and his father says that this should be an inspiration for a lot of teenagers. I'm not entirely sure I agree with his father, but congratulations to young Mike anyway.
And finally, Canada now offers a fitness tax credit for the parents of athletic kids. Are you surprised to learn that bowlers and golfers want a break?
Absolutely not. I'll tell you one thing, though. If the bowler thing catches on, the state of Wisconsin is going to have nobody paying the income tax ever.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Nothing's for free, but it can be bought really inexpensively. Take these golf clubs. I bought them just down the street at a garage sale.
You can listen at leisure to Only a Game podcasts or to programs past and present by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. As a child, Pete Maravich once described himself as a basketball android. He played at Louisiana State University from 1966 to 1970, broke scoring records, and brought the spotlight to a program that had been mediocre. As a pro, Pistol Pete earned the admiration and respect of such champions as Jerry West and Elgin Baylor, though he never played for a winner. In a new book titled Maravich, Wayne Fetterman and Marshall Terrell tell the story of the man they credit with inventing Showtime on the court. Wayne Fetterman joins me now from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Mr. Fetterman, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and it was a very nice introduction.
At what point did Pete Maravich recognize himself as a basketball android, to return to that introduction? And what does that mean, anyway?
Well, he meant he was possessed by the game of basketball, and that that consumed his thoughts and his life for a number of years, to the point that he wasn't a complete person. He was merely this one thing, and that's all he could do. And I guess probably when he was, I'd say, a second or third year in the pros, he started referring to his childhood as becoming a basketball android.
To what extent was becoming a basketball android a function of Press Maravich, Pete's dad?
Well, it was a collaboration between the two of them. I mean, obviously, Press Maravich, who used basketball as his escape route out of the Pennsylvania steel mills, wanted to create this incredible basketball player. And fortunately for Press, and maybe unfortunately for the family, Pete took to it rather well and even exceeded Press's desires. Pete would practice by himself 8-9 hours a day alone in this gym in Clemson, South Carolina, doing all these drills over and over again, and was just consumed by basketball. At the time, he loved it, but later he realized that maybe he should have had a little more balance in his life.
Describing an LSU game in which Pete was, as usual, spectacular, Skip Bayless of the Dallas Times-Herald wrote, quote, "I thought I saw God." What accounts for that level of hyperbole?
Well, one, I guess to move newspapers. Two.
Good answer.
Thanks. Two, he staggered your imagination. I don't know if it was a religious experience, but it was certainly along those lines for a lot of people who watched him. He was just breathtaking to watch. And every time he came down the court, even teams and opponents and opponents' crowds would start cheering for him to do something spectacular. It was quite bizarre, considering they were trying to beat the LSU Tigers at the time.
During a physical exam that Pete Maravich had while he was still in college, a doctor detected a heart murmur. He expressed his alarm to both Pete and Press, Pete's dad. He wanted to run some tests, but Pete and his dad didn't want that. Why not?
Well, I guess they were, one, living by the rule that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, Pete had just come off scoring 44.3 points a game, I think he did his junior year, and ran up and down the court, was the runner-up for player of the year. And at that time, they were like, you know, we just want to keep playing basketball. And also, they were a little paranoid of doctors.
Though he had been pointing toward a career in pro basketball from the time he was a small child, just weeks after he played his very first pro game with the Atlanta Hawks, Pete Maravich began talking about walking away from basketball. Why was that?
Well, this is why I love this story, is because here was a guy who was just mesmerizing to watch on the court, the consummate showman, made everyone happy, and was miserable playing pro basketball right from the start. He was brought into a team that had a winning record. He was paid much more money than anyone on that team. Plus, he was getting endorsement deals. Any one of those endorsement deals, one of them was for basketballs, one of them was for shoes, for pro kids, and the third one, most notably, was for Vitalis dry control hair product. Any one of those endorsement deals was worth more than a season's worth of pay for his teammates.
So the misery he felt came from the resentment that everybody else on the court felt toward him.
Right. Now, I will say this. Before he even got to the pros, he was starting to feel the pressure of being this Pistol Pete, this icon. He, even at that point, started talking about, I wish I had a simple life. I wish I could be an accountant. I wish I could be a beach bum, he told a gentleman, which was a number of these what I call contradictions of, you know, a guy who dedicated himself to basketball and yet made him incredibly unhappy. A gentleman who was a consummate showman yet painfully shy in real life.
Following his retirement from the NBA, Maravich was so lost that he thought about suicide. That's one of the things you write. And then, as you write about that time, one night he heard a voice. Tell me about that experience.
Pete Maravich was up in his bedroom and could not go to sleep. It was early in the morning. And then he claims he heard audibly in the room these words, "Be strong, lift thine own heart." And he actually woke his wife, Jackie, up and said, did you hear that? And Jackie was like, no, I didn't hear anything. Go back to sleep. But Pete claimed he heard it and prayed for salvation. And from that moment on was a completely changed man. All the angst he had, all the self-doubt he had was all washed away and replaced by a happy, content man who was thrilled to be alive and helping people. So it was a complete transformation that night in 1982 when he heard those words.
How did he integrate his experience as a basketball player into his mission as an evangelical Christian? Because he didn't put away basketball.
Well, at the beginning he did. And then slowly he realized that he could use his basketball skills and the fame that he created to help tell his story of salvation. And he became an extremely popular speaker to the point of that Billy Graham used him in 1987 to speak on a national television broadcast and in front of 35,000 people in South Carolina. And basically he just would mesmerize people the way he did on the court with this story of growing up and playing basketball and how none of it made him happy. He would often say, I wouldn't trade my position in life right now for 1,000 NBA championships. Mm-hmm. So he had gone 180 degrees around.
Pete Maravich died at the age of 40, and doctors discovered that he had only one instead of the normal two arteries supplying blood to his heart. If Pete and his father had let the doctor who heard that heart murmur back when Pete was still in college examine him more thoroughly, could his premature death perhaps have been prevented?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we don't know. I mean, we spoke to a doctor who said basically those who have this condition don't find out about it until it's too late.
You know, sad as Maravich's death was because he was only 40 years old when he passed away, there is a kind of shape to his life which is there because of the way he died. He was on a basketball court and playing a pickup game with a bunch of other guys with whom he was doing church business.
It's almost like a screenplay had been written for that part of his life, that he was playing basketball. And I don't know if you know, his last words were, I feel great. Then he dropped to the floor. People thought he was kidding around in that kind of way. And then they realized that he had suffered a massive heart attack at that point and never regained consciousness.
With Marshall Terrell, Wayne Fetterman wrote Maravich, published by Sport Classic Books. Mr. Fetterman joined me from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Verratti. Special thanks to Vince Fairchild and Matt Odette. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Maravich, listen to stories, past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the Sporting News' Paul Attner, who responds to my admiration for his football passion.
You think I got passion for football? Man!
Another man whose cover has been blown. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org.